You've heard the buzzword for years. Scale onboarding, CSMs should be doing training. Digital is a strategy, not a segment. But here's the truth. Most customer success teams are juggling a mess of tools, changing priorities, and have barely enough bandwidth to breathe, let alone scale. That vision we've all been chasing, it is finally real. Learning isn't trapped inside an LMS anymore. It's embedded across the entire customer journey. And that's where Skilljar, now part of Gainsight, is changing the game. Skilljar is becoming the backbone of scalable self-serve learning, whether it's in your academy, inside your product, in your community, or beyond. And because it's integrated with Gainsight's customer OS, it connects to where your customer data and your CSMs already live. This isn't theory, it is happening now. Companies like Airtable, Zendesk, Okta, Miro, and Asana are already doing it, with Skilljar and Gainsight leading the charge. So if you're ready to stop duct taping your customer education strategy together, visit Skilljar.com today.
Welcome to C-Lab, the customer education lab, where we take customer education myths and misconceptions and we put them in the grinder to make a delicious herbed sausage. I am Adam Avramescu, and I was trying to think about like maybe we extrude pasta or something like that, because I'm here today with my good friend and coworker here on the Personio Scaled CX team, Roberto Aiello. Hi, Roberto.
Hello, Adam. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. It's weird because, like, on one hand, we're doing an episode of this podcast, and on the other hand, we work together. So, you know, we might just be on Slack before or after this talking about a completely unrelated topic, but I'm glad we're, like, taking some time for this.
Exactly. Yeah.
Roberto, I have a... I know we started with Italian food. Well, first of all, can you think of a better metaphor for what we should do to customer education myths and misconceptions than what I came up with? I was thinking of like sausage and pasta and things like that. I don't know. Is there a better food metaphor?
No, sausage and pasta is a good one. I would add ricotta to that.
Okay, let's add some ricotta to the mix. But you know what we shouldn't add to the mix? And this breaks my heart as a Canadian to say, but we should not add maple syrup to the mix.
And no, not on that. Sorry.
No, we shouldn't do that. Like we tend to add maple syrup to a lot of things. And in fact, this time of year, we would go to the forest and we would get ice and you would like pour the maple syrup kind of like out from the tree from a tap onto the ice. And you would just like eat it just like that. Because today is National Maple Syrup Day.
Oh, that's so cool. And you know what? We had something similar in Southern Italy, at least.
Southern Italy? You have maple trees?
Yeah, no. I mean, taking the ice, take the fresh snow, like as a child, but people still does it. When there is snow, people go out in the morning, get the fresh snow from the top, you know, and they pour on it, not maple syrup, but they would put coffee or honey or figs on it. Oh. So the concept, the idea is the same. It's just
different. Yeah, that sounds very nice. When I think of Southern Italy, what always comes to mind for me is like delicious, like frozen desserts that are citrusy.
Yeah, that's during the summer, maybe mainly, and December as well. Yeah.
Yeah, because like there's always that other citrus season in the winter, which surprises me. It doesn't feel like time, but then it's like, hey, it's nice. It feels like summer.
Yeah. And it's interesting because what we just did was localization, right? We spoke about localization, like how you take something in two different places and have two different ingredients based on culture and products.
Yeah, that is true. We localized an analogy about frozen treats that we like between our different regions of the world and different cultures, which is going to be a great bridge into today's episode because, like you mentioned, I mean, at Personio, we have been working on a lot of really interesting challenges around localization. We, like many companies, have been exploring how we use AI as part of our education and scaled and content programs. And you've been deeply involved in all of this as our senior learning experience designer. And obviously, in addition to that, you are a big voice in the customer education world and have background even before you came to Personio on this. So, I mean, first of all, I would just start with the fact that I'm grateful that we've had our time together on the team and for, you know, the expertise that, that you brought in, but also the contributions that, that you've made to the team in our time together.
I think those were like, all great time, really. Like, I'm so grateful that I made this the decision at some point to transition and coming into Personio and starting the voyage with you, right?
Yes, that's a cheeky analogy to our educational platform, our Scaled CX platform, Voyager, Personio Voyager. So yes, we have also been on a voyage together, and I think this is where usually I would make the joke about, you know, let me take off my boss hat and we can just talk as like a host and interviewee. But I think it's always a little bit hard to do that because we're going to talk about some of the specific things that we've done together, but also because at the time that I'm recording this, I'm leaving Personio. I think that also lets us speak a little bit more freely without our power dynamics. You know, none of this is going to show up on the performance review or anything like that. Okay. Maybe in a good way because you did the podcast. I don't know. Let's see. Let's ask Beaker.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you were talking about localization, and let's get back into that because we at Personio, being an international company and serving a lot of European markets, but having English as our working language, I think has put us in a really interesting situation with some challenges that a lot of other companies who might be listening to this like might not have the same problem. So can you take us a little bit into the problem statement there?
Yeah. And I just wanted to say this, like I don't work specifically in a localization team, but localization has always been a topic dear to me because, you know, we just spoke, like I'm Italian and growing up in Italy, everything was localized, like movies, ads, even The Simpsons, you know, like if you would watch Simpsons in Italy, it would be an entirely different experience to you, for sure.
Do they have like different dialects, or how does that?
Yes,
does
exactly.
That work?
Like, it's so ingrained in the Italian culture. Like for example, the commissioner, the cop, he speaks with a very strong Neapolitan accent. It's ingrained into the, you know, not the so nice stereotype that people in that area might be more lazy or something, which is a stereotype. So like every stereotype is not, for sure, is not always true. And you may find lazy people everywhere in the world.
And like The Simpsons themselves, like the family, where are they supposed to be from in Italy?
They are not specifically from any region.
Okay, they're speaking a more like generic Italian.
Generic Italian, yes, exactly. I think it's more about those characters, the commissioner and all around them.
I guess that's true because like they're taking, again, this is localization, right? Like in the US version, in the English version, those characters are also speaking very regional accent. Like Chief Wiggum, the police commissioner, he's speaking in like, I think he kind of has like a New England kind of accent. Like he's a little bit of this like Boston cop stereotype, which like might have some of the same connotations, but not exactly the same. Right. So like, it is interesting, like you're talking about localization. They're not just saying like, oh, let's make him a Boston cop who's speaking in Italian, because that wouldn't make any sense. Let's rather say like kind of what do we do to find sort of like an Italian equivalent that might evoke some of the same ideas.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I find that so interesting. And when we talk about SaaS companies and tech companies, like you said, there are many companies and they produce and distribute their content just in English. But in Europe, but I would say not only Europe, in many other countries, people just, customers would expect products talk in their language and also talking in a way that sounds native to them. And I say this because, I mean, that's the main challenge that we had at Personio when starting. Like, we are a team, the Voyager team was mainly made of people with a, like, without the German as a native speaker, and German is the biggest market for Personio. So we were in this interesting situation where we produce content in English and then we translate afterwards for the biggest audience.
Which is like something, by the way, that's done across many teams at Personio, because our working language is English at the company internally. So we have a lot of people, even though we're, you know, have been originally from the German market, and certainly it's still our largest market. Like, we have a huge presence in DACH. We didn't hire only German speaking people, like yourself and myself included. Like, we're not we're not German native speakers. And so it's interesting from a, even from like a company strategy perspective, to say, like, do you always want people who are speaking the same language as your market distribution? Or if you're going to agree to have an internal company language, do you optimize for bringing in talent and like certain skill sets regardless of the language they speak, or like whether they're bilingual? So like, you can only imagine from the perspective of trying to build the company and think of the talent strategy and the location strategy, like that introduces some like interesting decisions and constraints.
Yes. If we talk practically, we have this in our courses in at the Voyager Academy. We have the, this framework, and for example, we have some section. One is called White Matters, and this was an interesting one for me, because an important learning moment when we realized. So in the beginning, we were giving the content to the people, to the vendor, for the translation. And we wanted to make sure we were giving as instructions that they had to translate this and as why it matters. Like, it had to be the same, really, like, it had to be translated the same way. But then over and over, we were getting feedback basically saying, no, this sounds weird to us. Like, it's it doesn't sound native to a German reviewer and the German person. So we learned that some phrasing simply couldn't be translated while keeping the same feeling. So the German needs a different rhythm, more structure, more precision. So if you force the English tone, it doesn't sound native, and customers feel it immediately. So that's why we, at some point, we became aware of this, and we let the market, the reviewer, do their job, you know, and trust them with this.
Yeah, and I mean, we have a lot of feedback mechanisms in place to also make sure that, you know, sometimes something will be written by either the agency or by a non-native speaker, and even it gets reviewed by a native speaker. Sometimes in the end, like another native speaker might look at it and they say, hey, well, this still doesn't sound natural to me. So we need a lot of those feedback mechanisms in place to kind of like vet and double vet, because we just don't know, right? It's like, it's impossible for us to look at it and say, hey, does this sound completely natural? But that said, we have learned some things about how to localize efficiently and how to kind of translate some of the tone and things like that. So like, maybe do you want to talk a little bit about some of the lessons that we learned and also like some of the, maybe the unsolved mysteries and things that are still hard for us?
So what we learned, it's definitely like we let the market do their job. Like we let those people to translate and localize. And like you said, we have systems in place, so we can validate that. Then there is the terminology. Like, it's I would say it's still a continuous learning. Like, what terminology do we translate? What we leave as it is? So there is a lot of research. Like, what English terms are ingrained now in the culture of another country, in this case Germany, and for example, what is that that you can find on the dictionary in that language, or it's widely used in certain industries. right?
Yeah, like if you're talking to like certain demographics or like certain industries like tech, like you're going to hear more what they would call it like Dinglish, right? Like Deutsch mm-hmm. English, where they're just kind of using the English term instead of like translating it back into German.
Exactly. So product also moves fast. So terminology is an interesting also challenge that because
yeah,
it has.
And they're often we're trying to even keep up with like, what does our product team choose the name to be? Do they use do they use a certain term for something? Do they use the English name? How do they localize? And then like we're a little bit on the back of that.
Yeah, another interesting thing that we do so far in the academy is that we have recently we translated, also we localized the academy in Spanish too for the essential path. And we have three instances. So when we record demos and take screenshots, we do this in English, in the German instance, and in the Spanish instance. What's interesting to me is also that we decided to use for the HR person name that we use for our storytelling, we use localized names. So we have Emma Sanchez for the Spanish, Emma Mueller for the German. So I think that's a level that it's not always necessary, to be honest, in my opinion, but it's might be a nice to have.
It's a nice touch. Yeah. And we also have to call out Nari on the learning experience design team for her heroic efforts to do the Spanish translation as well.
Yeah, she's doing a great job.
Yeah.
And then I think if we talk about best practices or exactly what we learned, like don't force the English tone, align the terminology. Use AI for speed. This is something we started exploring last year, and it's proved very, very useful, especially now. I mean, for sure. Like,
do you want to say more about that? Because like that's a super interesting area.
Yeah. So I mentioned Spanish. We needed to do some translation in Spanish, but we didn't need to be extremely precise from the beginning. So my idea was, as I was experimenting already a lot with AI assistants, I decided, okay, I build this AI assistant. I feed it with all our terminology, glossary, rules, like use direct language, actionable verbs, all of these. I fed it into this, and we tested it, and Nari helped also with this a lot, and the result was pretty exciting. We were cutting time from the translation, and the quality was already very good for the reviewer, and the reviewer was able to give us a final version to use. So I think with time, this is going to be even better. I mean, it's going better by day, really. And
you're talking here about, for instance, like the assistants.
Yes.
For translate. Yes. So like maybe it's worth taking a little bit of a step back for the audience, because I think a lot of people are doing things like this already, but like might be helpful to talk specifics. We have a program, the software at Personio called LangDoc, and LangDoc is an aggregator of various LLMs. So it allows you to select the model that you want to use. So whether you want to use like OpenAI models or Anthropic's models or Google's models, right? Like they're all in there. And with that, you can also build custom assistants. Right. So that's their terminology, their generic terminology for it. But yeah. Those who are like in the OpenAI system, like you can think of it as like the custom GPT, where you can like write your own instructions for it. You can fine tune it and all of that. So this is what you're talking about here, basically having like created some very purpose built assistance for tasks like translation with like certain style guide rules in place.
Yeah, that's right. So I created this assistant. As I said, I added all our documents, so a list of all the glossary, terminology, mm-hmm. rules, And the assistant was able to apply those rules whenever we were asking to translate some piece. And as I said, like we tested it and the results are great. So, and in a flow that is already very complex, so at that time at least, we would produce the content in English, submit to a vendor for the initial translation, then the vendor would send it back, then we would have an internal review, and then finally we would use this. Yeah. Basically, using an assistant, we would cut the time waiting from the vendor to get the internal review. Now, the workflow a bit changed, but I mean, at the time, that something like this would help a lot.
Yeah, and I think it also calls out some interesting parts of the AI evolution in the sense that that solves a local problem very well. A localization problem, but I also mean local in the sense that like it solves a specific problem in a specific area.
Yep.
But there's still work to be done, and this is work that's in progress, to also then get that work that's working really well to kind of flow back into the general localization system. Because again, for listeners who might not be as close to the localization world, when you localize, you need a translation memory. And that's basically all of the translations that have ever been done into a various language. What term did you translate into what other term? How do you talk about this? Because if you're using AI for localization at scale, you need the translation memory basically to be the source, or almost like the mega glossary to help train that AI on how it's going to localize in the future. So that makes you more and more efficient. Whether you're using a third-party system or whether you home build one and are doing like an internal LLM. So that's kind of like the next stage of this is like you get the systems working really well locally, but then there's this whole other body of work that sits behind that on that, excuse me, then how to get all of them to talk to each other so that like then you can actually automate it at scale.
That's right. Like translation memory is such an important piece. And it's great that you mentioned it because it's like that. Like we have an assistant, we have multiple assistants that help us, but then it's also about integrating them into an entire workflow. Otherwise you miss that part on translation memory. And in the end of the day, the hardest part of all this isn't translation itself, it's the maintenance.
Yeah, it's the maintenance, and it's also like getting these systems integrated with each other so that you you don't update something, for instance, in one system and then another system doesn't know about it, so it gets mistranslated over there. So exactly. I think those are the things sometimes the connective tissue people don't think about as much.
Right.
Especially when it's like, oh, but this thing that we're doing over here is working. It's like, yeah, but yep. We're going to have to do it like 16 times a day over here.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Because then updates can be affected, and updates is still a challenge. I think it's a challenge for many teams. At least talking to other people, like they all have the same. I mentioned we take screenshots also with the UI in different languages. So imagine like anytime, and we do just for now two languages, maybe sometimes three. But for example, like when I was working in Zendesk, we were doing five languages, but we were using the UI all in English. Because anytime, if you do it our way and you have multiple languages, imagine something changes, you have to multiply the work to be done.
Yeah. It's not like a cheap investment to just add languages, even if you think you're cutting corners. But you started getting, I mean, we started talking a little bit about LangDoc and the custom GPTs and things like that. I think that would be great for us to spend a little bit more time on and talk generally, like how you and I guess how we as a team are using AI, because you have been one of the more, let's say, AI pioneers on the team. And I think in general, in our space, it's something that you've really been embracing. So I think it'd be super helpful to hear some of the other ways that you've been using AI to accelerate content production and also kind of help with some of these other use cases.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, like I started experimenting with AI from the beginning when it started to be mainstream. But I think the turning point at Personio came with when I worked on a specific course about compensation. That I think that's the clearest example. So I had to work on this compensation course. It wasn't a product focused course. It was mainly an HR skill topic.
Yeah, because we had a compensation product, but like it's one thing to say, hey, we have a compensation product, but another thing to say, like, okay, if you're like a small to medium German Mittelstand, they call it, business, you might not know how to do an effective compensation model or program. So like you need to be taught how to do that.
Exactly. I mean, for full context, that was it. Like we, as it usually happens in many companies, we had marketing, someone else coming and say, hey, we need a new course about compensation. As a designer, my question is, do we really need it? Let's explore that. And then we found out exactly that the product itself wasn't too complex to use. But as you said, many small and medium companies may not have a compensation specialist. So it was more about foundational knowledge. And that's when we decided, okay, let's do this hybrid. Let's do this HR skill topic course. And so I had an initial call with a subject matter expert internal. And just to understand the fundamentals.
Like one of the members of our compensation team that does like compensation for Personio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's when I had the idea to integrate AI in my flow. At that time, and I think many people can relate to this. So we have SME, very busy, with a team that at that point was already under reorg. So few time, just little time to speak to me. So I had an initial call with him. I learned something, understood something. And then I told myself, okay, this is not something product related. So it's not something related to knowledge that we only have in Personio. This is a HR skill topic. So there must be already a lot of knowledge widely available out there in the internet. So I used, in this case, LangDoc, and as you said, the advantage is that we can use many models with it and we can experiment.
Were you doing some perplexity research as well?
Yeah. And then I used the AI to structure and generate a first draft for this. On my own, for sure, I would never have been able to write content at that level of expertise. But because compensation is a well-documented area, AI could help me build a solid 60-70% draft. That was the main surprise when I went back to the SME and I showed it. And he said, this already looks really good. So instead of spending time drafting from scratch, he simply added the nuances and what really matters. So real examples from his experience, best practices, things only someone in compensation would know. Oh, sorry.
Oh, magic. That's a sound effect that represents the magic of AI.
Yes. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's good. And like, maybe what surprised you about that draft? Like, what were some of the things maybe that you were able to accomplish using AI that you didn't necessarily think like, you thought maybe like, surely I as a human like would need to do all of this part myself.
This episode is brought to you by Parda.io. Parda is a next generation authoring platform built for customer education. Okta, Personio, Miro, Writer, and many other fast-growing companies rely on Parda to stay in sync with product updates, build customer learning experiences, and manage content at scale. With Figma-style collaboration, granular branding, built-in localization, an AI assistant, seamless skill jar integration, and more, Parda lets you scale customer education the way it should be: fast, flexible, and collaborative. To learn more, check them out today at parda.io/CLab. That's parda.io/CELab.
I think it was very, very well drafted. Like it was, okay, I also, like when I prompted, I didn't simply prompt give me a course about compensation. My prompt was very long, giving all our framework, context. The same framework we apply when we create content. So use actionable verbs, find all the learning objectives that matter in this context. So, and the result was really good. So all the basics were there, and then they were ready for us to inject all those nuances into the course.
Yeah. And I like the way that you're talking about this, because fundamentally, a lot of people are worried AI is going to come and replace our jobs. But what you're describing here is not that. What you're describing here is still a very human in the loop process, but it's helping you work faster and it's helping your SME work faster in the sense that they can give you more raw notes with their busy time. They don't need to sit down and author a bunch of stuff themselves. You, as the instructional designer in this case, don't need to spend as much time with the formatting and getting things into that certain format, into the certain style, really thinking about all the different things that he said and translating those into an initial draft. But both of your brains are still very active in this process, because he still needs to give you the SME information. You still need to distill what's important or not important. You need to look at that draft and add the nuance. And, even though they say it's easier to edit than to write, editing is still a skill and still takes time. And then ultimately he still needs to also verify the information that's in there. So we're not talking about a completely automated process here. No. We're talking about a human in the loop AI process, which is cool.
Yes, exactly. In this case, this is really where we can say that AI didn't replace the expertise. It just changed where the expertise is applied in this case.
Yeah, but also still save time, right? Because sometimes the counter argument is we need to spend just as much time prompting and reprompting and all of that. But because you gave a thorough enough prompt with the style guides and the references and your expectations ahead of time, you didn't need to spend as much time generating this AI slop garbage out draft that then you had to polish into something.
Yeah. And that was, so the first time I used it this way, that was the unexpected benefit was more strategic thinking time. So because AI handled the heavy drafting, I suddenly found myself with more time to think strategically, something that before in similar projects I never done, because I never had time for that. It was just about drafting and creating the content and reviewing. And in this case, what I've done was not just delivering the project earlier, but using that extra time to do something that I never done before. So meaning I started drafting, okay, I need to provide some context here. So what I learned, very interesting to me about compensation, is that there are few industry movement during the year. So when it's October, there is a managers start budgeting. Then when it's August, September, the companies, vendors start releasing the what are they called, the report for that then companies can use to do benchmark and so on. So with that extra time, I started drafting proposals for DCX and for communities, distribution ideas, timing campaigns around HR moments, budgeting season and how content could live in the community. So I think that was a great use of my extra time.
Yeah, because for instance, we've spent a lot of time on doing all of the analysis and the drafting and the actual content creation. If you use the Addy process as the framework for this,
yeah.
But that often, like if you think about how Addy looks in practice, it doesn't leave us a ton of time usually to think about distribution and how all this content that we're creating is going to get into the hands of our customers. So it's cool that it gave you some time back to also like spend more time on that part so that this content doesn't just go in the LMS and then die unseen.
Exactly. And so after I did that, once I had this workflow that worked, the next step for me was to scale it. So I turned my own prompts and mental process into a set of LangDoc assistants for the entire team. So I created the one, and I created several because as you know, assistants are better if they are good, if they're just,
it should be like purpose built.
So I have this, I created these three assistants for the team, one for brainstorming and ideation that would include also already some of these ideation for extra activities like distribution, community events. Then another assistant that's the core for the course design and development with a structured methodology similarly to what I did for the for the translation one, like it's about like feeding it with our framework and how we work. And then the third assistant for promotional comms, like it's something that it's a routine admin work after we complete a course, we need to communicate through different channels and generate emails, posts, different set of copy. And so I created those two. And this helped the team a lot, like in the same way. So giving them more time to think strategically, reducing the time to draft. And also something that it's also very dear to me, staying more to keep the content more consistent. Mm-hmm. And on brand, because I think this could be also a challenge when a team gets bigger and you have new hires. Sometimes people start creating content in their own way, forgetting at times, you know, that we are part of a company and we represent a brand. So I think assistants really help in this as well.
Yeah. And also when SMEs start creating their own content, because sometimes not everything can be like, you know, perfectly designed by a learning experience designer, having more guardrails and more tools that make, you know, their more like raw input look more consistent with the output is helpful. And here's also probably where we should talk about the other tool in our tool stack here that helps us with this, Parta, right?
Yeah, I mean, we use that. And I think your example was better than mine. For SMEs, being able to rely on tools like Parta for reviews and AI assistants can definitely help to take that content from SME and get it already in a good workable way for us to complete the product.
Yeah, and just for listeners who might not know what this is, I'll try to keep this quick so it doesn't turn into an ad, but we make heavy use of Parta at Personio. You could think of it as it's collaborative content creation, sort of, you know, like Figma style collaborative editing, but also with a high focus on brand consistency, right? So we're able to have the learning and the experiences that we create in Parta be very on brand and feel more like sleek and modern and sophisticated. And you don't have to like overly template it, but you can still, for instance, have a SME collaborating with you in the content. So that really helps in terms of getting like consistent output, in a quicker way. And they're also thinking about, you know, even distribution in an AI first world. And we should probably talk about that in a moment, but sorry, Roberto, you're about to say something too.
No. I wanted to say the brand aspect, like that was one of the reasons we chose Parta at some point, because we didn't want another platform that would make look our courses just the same as as every other course out there, we wanted to deliver on brand, because we invested a lot in that.
Well, which is why we made the decision early on to say, hey, we would rather use the native authoring in our LMS than to use a third party rapid development form based e-learning software. I'm deliberately not naming names, but I think a lot of people know what I'm talking about, just because we wanted that level of flexibility and we wanted things to still feel like Personio and not introduce that additional layer of complexity and SCORM syncing and things like that. And so Parta kind of came to us midway through, but really ended up solving a lot of those problems, I think, in a more interesting way. I'd probably also give a shout out in terms of AI tooling to Cluso, who has been helping us a lot on the AI generated video front.
Yes.
It's another one we make heavy use of.
Yeah, that's a great one too. We are so happy to use it. It's just so easy. Like, more people are able to provide a well done draft, nearly ready. So our video team is small, it's not big. So having, that's a huge help for them, because they just need to tweak and refine it a bit. But the drafts are more than draft.
And being able to use the same source content then to localize into different languages, right? Because we need variants of a lot of our videos in languages. Being able to do that with AI assistance is helpful. And before we go fully on to distribution, still while we're talking about AI tooling, that both creating LangDoc assistance and doing some of this improvements of the workflow in Cluso, and probably even some other things that I'm not thinking of. These were things that our team all took on as part of the company did an AI Surge Week. Do you want to talk about that, Roberto? I thought that was a super interesting thing that we did.
Yeah, it was super great. So we ran this AI Surge Week at Personio. The goal was to really made aware everyone in the company about AI and go over the misconceptions and really make people in the company, everyone, to feel confident about using AI. And in the specific, what I did, I co-designed a workshop with colleagues from marketing and CX, Ian and Mia. And so we designed this workshop to help others get comfortable using
AI. The whole company, right? Yeah, it was a company-wide workshop.
Yeah, it was company-wide, more suggested for marketing and CX, because the AI Search Week involved so many people and was company-wide. Then we in our team, we designed this workshop. Everyone in the company could attend this, and it was about AI for content creation. So everything I said so far, plus the experience from Mia's and Ian's experience about content creation with AI, we distilled that knowledge with examples, and we presented it in this during this workshop. And the great thing, the response was great. Many people started the week skeptical and ended it curious and even inspired. So showing practical workflows was what changed everything.
Yeah, and even showing there were some real examples of iteration, right? Let's start with this prompt. Let's see what it gets us. Ooh, that's not perfect. How do I refine from there? And knowing that being able to work with AI and being able to prompt and reprompt and feed it with context, and even eventually, we talked about, kind of do proper integrations, automation, work with MCPs. These are all skills, and they're skills that can be cultivated over time.
Yes.
And even though it's not going to be perfect, I think sometimes people expect magic from AI, cultivating the skill and continuing to work at these things, you still can accomplish things that we would not have been able to do without this technology in place.
Exactly. I think you made a great point. It's about iteration. I think many people still sees this as a, what appears, maybe what surfaces, are from many people looking at as gurus, and they do magic with AI. It's not that. It's really approaching with humbleness and just a lot of curiosity, and use your skills, the ones you already have, and with patience and iterations, you get there. Like, we are in an interesting time in history. Like, anyone can become an expert in AI. When we're talking about really AI experts, for me, are just the people that develop those models. Like, everyone else as a user, we can all learn.
Yeah, and personally, I'm not one of those people that's like super FOMO about AI. Like, I think it's all these tools are out there. They all exist. You're not missing the boat if you haven't done it yet. You're not going, like, I don't think you're not going to like shrivel up and die if you don't use it. But like, at the same time, like, opposing it, well, you're probably going to be cutting yourself off from the ability to use interesting tools that will help you do things better and faster. So I think approaching with curiosity and iteration the way that you've mentioned, and like figuring out what the tools available, like, okay, how can I set up some basic automations for myself? Or how can I set up assistants that help me do some of my common tasks? How can I share those with the rest of my team? Like, I love that you have done that for the team. And I love that you continue to explore those areas. And I also equally love that, you know, what we're seeing from the different vendors in the space, they're all thinking about how they use these tools as well to help automate and abstract more of that along with us, so that we don't have to build all of these solutions from scratch. We have thought partners in doing this. Even the problem statement that you were talking about earlier about products that update really quickly, and then us needing to figure out how to update all of the content, I'm even starting to see some people try to solve that using AI. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Cluso is working on a solution there. There's another company called Sammy Labs that is trying to solve that problem. So, you know, if you're looking at your 2026 tech stack, listeners, there are some really interesting solutions out there in the content space and in the digital and scaled CS space that are, I think, like, not just like AI sprinkled into an existing product, but really thinking about how do we use AI in a more like fundamentally useful way.
Yes, yes. Hopefully it will, something will happen and we will be able to remove more friction using AI.
I hope so too. Now, Roberto, we had one more topic that we wanted to come back to, and we alluded to it a few times because you were talking, for instance, about, okay, we can create great content, but let's use those extra brain space to actually think about how it gets distributed. And this has actually been a big focus of yours in the past months as well, because our training team, our academy team, has been working closely with our digital customer experience team in other companies that's known as digital customer success, as well as our product team, to try to solve some more like fundamental problems about how we drive customer outcomes. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that problem and how you went about it.
Yeah. So you mentioned DCX and product. Even before that was the implementation specialist.
Yeah, the people who are on the ground doing this work every day.
Exactly. So yeah, it's about... So what we did practically, we were, as we do every quarter, reviewing our content and how it performs, and so it started from there, like how we can make it more valuable for customers onboarding Personio, and so we've been working on a project to realign academic content, at least what we used to call essential learning path, with the activation milestones customers need to achieve during setup. So for me, that was a very interesting one, and because it makes you feel you can have an impact, a more impact into customers' life. So instead of thinking, here's our academy, go learn everything, the shift is what do customers need to do right now in this exact step of their journey? So, and how do we give them just the content that helps them achieve that? So in the end, it was very, very simple, like tedious, but simple. So taking all the activation milestones we have in the company, so we know we have definitions for when we consider a customer activated or a feature activated, a certain feature. So I took all this list and I started mapping. I have this huge dashboard, whiteboard in Confluence, because I mapped that against the learning path we had in Academy, but not only that, I cross mapped all of that also to the steps we have in the setup wizard within the product, and also within to the email implementation journey that the implementation specialist to customers. So,
and this is really important because for a product like Personio, which is about, you know, your core HR software, actually spending more time upfront to make sure that it's set up correctly and that it's going to serve as a system of record and that you're not going to reveal the wrong sensitive information to the wrong person, or that someone's not going to miss, you know, their payroll or something like that. That's really important. So maybe compared to some other products where you can have a relatively light implementation, but then expand your usage over time and get more sophisticated. With Personio, actually, the implementation and the sequencing of it really matters in terms of importance, but also like the way that we communicate to customers, whether it's you know, through our human implementation managers, through email, through in-app wizards, through Academy content, like all of that matters because we can't be giving them, you know, severely conflicting messages. So I think like that's just to frame up for the audience. That's why that was such a kind of a magnified problem statement for us.
Yes, yeah, and connecting all of these dots was so important. And and then it came also like the setup wizard. So we have the setup wizard in Personio, so customers can, without getting into the directly into all the different sections of the settings page, they have this guided path where they need to set up the important things. And also like, because I mapped the activation milestones to that, and the setup wizard is also mapped to the activation milestones, I was able to suggest the right content we have in the Academy that would be useful to surface at the right point. And you don't need to surface everything. We just need to surface the content where it matters. Maybe we have a step in the setup, one step that usually is can be a bottleneck or a block in the setup wizard is when we ask customers to upload their people data. And this is like a big moment for them, right? Because they may think, okay, what do I need to really upload? What can I keep aside? You know, we are talking about GDPR, data privacy. People sometimes are unsure about what to upload. So having, for example, a link to a course we have in the community or in the Academy, or something embedded that explains you the why it matters and why it's important for you, then can certainly help unblock that. And the same goes for other cross-functional teams. It's about really like to align and to surface the right content when it's needed.
And I mean, it's interesting too, in the sense that if you're starting an Academy from scratch, or you're starting an onboarding content path from scratch, your tendency, probably because generally you don't know any better, is going to be to do like exactly what you were describing, sort of like what we originally had in our essentials. Like take all the stuff about using the product, put it in some order that makes some sort of sense, and then, you know, try to send customers through it. But companies often make a few mistakes when doing that. One is one that I think we mostly avoided, luckily, because it's not our first rodeo creating content, which is like you take what's supposed to be your 101 course and you jam so much other information in there that you're like, oh, well, if that was the basic course, what am I supposed to put in my intermediate course or my advanced course? Well, hint, it was probably like 60% of the stuff that you put in your beginner course. So I think we sort of avoided that one. But the one that we still ended up doing is like, you know, you put things into a logical enough sequence, but over time, then you look at what your customers are actually doing and what, to your point, what are their actual anxieties that they're having? What are the actual stumbling blocks? Looking at, you know, kind of the actual activation flows in product, where are customers typically dropping off, and then use that to almost like remix your content path to be more focused on driving outcomes and unblocking customers where they need it versus being this just like comprehensive, here's all the things you need to know about using the product.
Yep.
And that's not easy, but it's worthwhile. And I think that's it, important to call out how you went about that.
Yeah, I think it's very satisfying, like because you have a deep understanding of all of it.
Yeah, and it's rooted in actual customer insights, which I think is cool. And that's also a good reason to shout at the implementation managers who are the ones actually working with the customers on this every day.
I think that's real design, right? When we think about design as a proper like word of really orchestrating, it's really great.
Yeah, and I mean, cool too that it was a cross-functional working group and included all the teams that we just talked about. And even at one point, there was like a really cool hackathon using like design sprint methodologies on, you know, what could even the future look like? How might we supercharge this? And I hope that, you know, I don't want, I'm not going to spoil the product roadmap, but hopefully these are things that we can bring to life in the coming year.
Yeah. And you mentioned the cross-functional team, like working in that way, it's great. And it's also a challenge, right? Because it's very difficult to have multiple teams moving at the same pace and in the same direction.
And they have different incentives and different day-to-day concerns, like product is working against the product roadmap or like other product areas' priorities. Implementation managers are working against, okay, if we just like get a spike in new deals and now we have to do twice as many implementations, well, then they're all overwhelmed. So you're right, like aligning the timing and the incentives can be challenging, but worthwhile.
Yeah.
Well, we've had a really good tour of localization and AI and distribution, three things that are, I think, worthy topics for any customer education or scaled CX team today. Are there any other takeaways, reflections, practical advice that you want to share before we start closing it out, Roberto?
Well, I would say for localization, like you don't need to translate everything. You can just analyze your content, the most performing, and then according to different market, just start localizing what you really need, and then measure and move from that. For AI, start experimenting if you haven't yet, and maybe start with the things that saves you time. And from there, when you have strong prompts that work, then scale, build a custom GPT, a custom assistant, and use it with the whole team so that you can help everyone. And for distribution, I think, stop. Maybe think if you don't, like that content, it's not everything. Like having a lot of content is not the solution. It's more about surfacing it the right way, when matters and where it matters and to who matters.
Yeah, let's start with the hypothesis about where customers are actually supposed to find this content. And ideally, it's not just relying on humans to be the ones to recommend it to customers. Yeah.
And the last reflection is really something we can bring in Personio again. Like I'm sure you saw, like we recently launched this AI overview for reports. So now you can, customers can really talk to reports and can chat with it. That's super cool. And that got me thinking a while ago, like maybe this is also a turning point for customer education. Like if we start having, and I'm sure it will happen more and more, maybe in 2026, if we start having more products that talk to their customers, maybe we don't need any more like tutorials or click here and click there to do something, because the AI is already embedded and it does that for you. So maybe we can focus on those decision making courses or an education that really goes to the fundamentals and nurture the critical thinking, decision making, and all those skills. Maybe that's gonna be next.
Yeah, I would agree, and I don't think it's going to go away entirely, but I think for any product that is operating in like, as you said, a more conversational manner, or where the workflows aren't necessarily click paths anymore, there's kind of two things that we need to think about. One, I think, is exactly the point you just made. Instead of teaching click paths, how do we teach more of the concepts and the schema, and what conversations might you have with the product to get the types of outcomes that you're thinking to drive? Because that's going to be the new hurdle for customers to clear. It's not like, where do I click to make this happen? It's, what do I ask to achieve my goals? So I could definitely see that evolving very quickly. But the other thing that I think is interesting about this whole click path thing is that's going to become more contextual. Like, that's been the dream for a long time, right? That we don't need standalone videos and courses and screenshots and documentation and doing side by side and all of that. And I don't think the technology is there yet to make that fully automated and agentic. Like, I think people are trying to solve that problem, but that's still a bit of a pipe dream to say that, agentic products should be able to completely predict what a customer is doing and then guide them through it dynamically. It's a solvable problem. I think it will happen at some point. I don't think we're there yet. Yeah. But I do think, like, in 2026, we will see somehow the guidance, at least, for what customers are supposed to do. Like, we'll have more options for how to bring that contextual. But I think, like, that's still probably the big hurdle to think about, is like how we do that and how we do that elegantly and without it making, you know, the product just turn into Clippy again. But now it's like AI Clippy.
Yeah, that's right.
And I mean, that's the fun of continuing to iterate and explore and be curious about what's ahead. So let's see what 2026 brings.
We'll see.
Roberto, it's been great chatting with you. And not just now, but obviously in general when we work together. And I hope that we've brought some of the fun and authenticity and general good vibes of our work together to the podcast as well.
Yeah, I think we did. Hopefully.
I think so too. Well, hopefully listeners, you felt the same way. And Roberto, where can people find you?
On LinkedIn mostly. Yeah, that's the platform I prefer.
Yep, you are pretty active on there, and then you're also we see you in webinars and things like that as well. So definitely give Roberto a follow if you are not following him already. And again, thank you, Roberto, for joining me today. And thank you to our listeners. If you want to learn more, we've got a podcast website at customer.education where you can find the show notes and other material. We also give a special thank you to Alan Coda for the theme music. In fact, I'm going to give a special thank you to the entire Personio education and Scaled CX team for everything that we've built together and turning Personio Voyager into the platform that it is. And I'm going to leave it there so I don't get sappy. And all I ask in return, not from our team, but from the listeners, is a positive review on Apple Podcasts, because that helped get the word out about what we're doing. So to our audience, thanks for joining us. Go out and educate, experiment, and find your people. Bon voyage.